should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be,
whether they are
weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Do we have any first-timers today? Everybody else is... Oh, timers. All professionals. But a few familiar faces, but other than that... So, I think usually... give a talk about meditation, why you should do it.
Yeah, and make us expert at the end of the day.
That's right, that's right. So are your problems. What's a good way to look at meditation? It's like, you know how we all want to live in a clean house, right? Clean house feels comfortable. Feels, you know, makes you brighter. It's enjoyable to live in a clean house. But as you all know, houses or apartments or places, it gets dirty from everyday use. The wind comes in, people drag dirt. There's things that just build up over time. And you have to maintain it, clean it regularly. You have a dirty house, sometimes you may not notice, but it's still, you know, like, you know, it's not so comfortable. Even with the little huts that we have, you know, we give it one good clean once a week, and it feels good, feels nice, feels comfortable. It's like spring cleaning. And if you don't clean your house, and that's what you do spring cleaning, you don't clean your house, things just build up. And after a while, a garage or a closet or something you don't look at, it may start to stink a little. That stink is not very nice. So sometimes I'm like, well, it doesn't matter, I just don't go near there. Don't worry about it. And over time, the smell starts to spread from the basement, it goes up to the room. And over time, it spreads everywhere, and you find, oh no, I can't live in this house anymore. To go somewhere else. Yeah. But our mind is like that. Our mind is also something that gets dirty in the sense that it gets, you know, unwholesome emotions. You get sad, you get grumpy, you get annoyed from time to time. And unless we have a routine of mental hygiene, a way to clean it, then it does get, you know, less energetic, more darker, a bit more depressing. You find that you just don't have that brightness, the zest, the oomph to relate to other people, to deal with life in general, or just to enjoy life. Yeah. And over time, you know, unless we know how to manage our mental health, unless we have a regime of regularly cleaning it, cleansing it, it just goes one way. Yeah. Houses don't become clean by themselves. Neither is the mind. But if you're only beginning to understand that, if you're only beginning to pay attention to mental health, that what things we do to help, or what things we do that hinders our happiness. Yeah. So it's not it's not something that happens by chance. So the good news is that yes, our mental health is important. But the second good news is something we can do about it. It doesn't happen by chance. Not like you're born happy or born unhappy. No, we all experience life. There are disappointments. There are challenges, there are obstacles from time to time. But with a good mental regime of cleaning, cleansing, we all can learn to be a bit happier, a bit more at ease, a bit more calm, a bit more clear. Yeah. Just like that little closet. And it's not enjoyable. But unless we start to, you know, go find the mop, open the door, and just bearing with the unpleasant, but cleaning it little by little, you'll find that the smell goes away. And you can live comfortable in your house again, having cleaned it. It's the same with the mind, though. And the thing is that if you have a dirty house, you can go on a holiday, stay in a hotel, go to your friend's house for a while. You can go to different places. The thing is, you have a smelly mind, an unclean mind, there's nowhere to go. You're stuck with it. The morning you wake up, the moment you go to sleep, you're stuck with this mind that's kind of smelly and stinky and not very happy. Yeah. But, like I said, it's not something mystical only monks and nuns do. Mental hygiene, mindfulness, clarity is something that people are beginning to understand more. Just like, you know, another gamble is just like physical health. We understand much more now, you know, how to have a healthy body, exercises, doing yoga, stretching, Pilates, all sorts of exercises to live a more healthier, have a healthier body. It's the same with the mind. We understand it's the same dynamics, really. Something that we have to exercise, to work at it. So happiness in the mind, contentment, a clearer mind, a healthy mind, it's not something mystical. It's something we all can work on. As long as, you know, it takes consistency, it takes persistence, but it's something each and every one of us can do, can aspire to. You might not get the amazing, flash, incredible bliss meditation right away, but each time you meditate, you just sense you're just that much more peaceful, that much more still, that much more open to life. So mind gets tired, and you think it's your fault somehow. But if you just have a tired mind, and the tired mind just comes from living daily life, interacting with people, thinking a lot, reading, you know, dealing with the mobile devices and internet and dealing with people, jobs and family, responsibilities, disappointments, arguments we have with our loved ones or people we work with, that just drains our energy, which is fine, that's just part of life. But there are ways to also increase, re-energize our mind just through simple process of meditation, of focusing the mind on one thing. You know, the mind gets tired when we start to think about too many things or get obsessed about certain things. It just drains away our energy. But we learn how to relax the mind, to allow it to be more open, allow it to be more still, you find the energy just comes up naturally. And the power of the mind is amazing once you learn how to cultivate it. It's the same with the body, but only so much more, many times stronger. Like you see, you know, these amazing weightlifters or Olympian doing gymnastic moves. They do this incredible thing that you don't think humanly possible for a body. Well, well-trained mind trumps that many times over. Amazing about power. Just to be happy, to be open, to accept life as it is. To accept the disappointments that comes with life from time to time. Understand that we all have to separate from what we love and to live with a body that's changing, that's aging. But it's not, it doesn't have to be a problem. We can accept the aging process as it as a natural course of events. Just like the trees, the leaves falling when it's fall, you don't get sad. Just understand it's a natural course of event. And so with life, life changes according to causes and conditions. As long as we learn to move with it, to accept it, to understand the change that comes from the world around us, then it's fine. We can live a life of peace, tranquility, a life of happiness and contentment. So then, when Ajahn Chah said, when you have wisdom, there is no problem. All the problem disappears. It's only when we are stuck, we want something, we're confused that there are problems in life. But once we see clearly, the problem solves themselves really. Understand the nature of life, there's really no problem. That's just changes. And that's normal. It's part of the world. We can't prevent that from happening, internally or externally. Okay? So tonight, one of the ways to kind of focus or train the mind is to bring your attention to one thing. It could be a physical object, could be kind of some, you know, you hear a lot of monks and nuns talk about it, the mindfulness of the breathing, just processing of the breathing process, or focusing on an idea, a concept of loving kindness, acceptance. But today I thought, because most of us live such fast-paced life, we have, you know, family, we have responsibilities, you have jobs, and kids to look after, partners to take care of, lots of things to be doing, and then we can feel quite rushed, tired, low energy. But it's just sometimes it's just a way of looking at things. So one way kind of help the mind to slow down is to focus on this idea of, certainly in meditations anyway, in real life, nothing to do, nowhere to go. For the next maybe half an hour, where's the clock? For the next half an hour, we can focus on, say, a mantra, a saying that kind of help us focus the mind. I'm just happy just to be here in this room. Happy to rest in the present moment. Rest in the here and now. You have full license to chill, relax, have to work out, whatever it is that's bothering you all day long. You can leave that for a while, just half an hour. Yeah? And just kind of relax the body. Relax the mind. Oh, I'm going to be okay. Yeah? So one way is that, yeah, just say quietly to yourself, nothing to do, nowhere to go. Or anything else that helps you just to stay here, to enjoy nice, cool, and quiet room, company of good people who are trying to train the mind, who are looking for ways to live skillful lives. Yeah. So, during your meditation, spend the next few minutes just kind of set yourself in a posture that you can hold comfortably for a good 30-35 minutes. Close your eyes, or you can just look in front of you, down towards the floor or the back of the chair. Your hands can be on your knees, on top of each other, whatever feels comfortable. And then spend the next few minutes just bringing your awareness into the physical sensations of the body. Just learning to relax, adjust your posture to allow the body to be comfortable. Awareness of different areas of the body, your shoulders. Allow that just to be at ease, to drop it. Awareness in the bottom of your feet, just touching the ground. Notice, what does that feel like? Just help focus the mind. Say quietly to yourself, now is meditation time. Time just to be here. To think about the past. Or trying to work out, solve any problems that you might be facing. You do that after the meditation session. That's the time just to focus on the here and now. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. Just happy to be here. Happy to be in this body of yours. There's nowhere you'd rather be, except right here, right now. Sure, the body is not perfect, might be some itches, slight discomfort somewhere, but it's good enough. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, just to be this body of ours, just to be here, whether it's the breathing process, the physical sensations in the body. Mind is thinking of different things, just be with the thinking. To try to stop thinking, but also no need to follow it. Allow the thoughts to come and go. Allow the sensations of the body to come and to go as well. To do, nowhere to go. So allow yourself just to rest in the moment. Rest in the presence of the here and now. any time during the meditation, you find that the mind drifts away. The past, or it starts to reach for the future and planning things, doing things. Just gently remind yourself, now it's meditation time. Just gently point the mind back to the body, back to the present moment, either with the breathing process or any physical sensations in the body. Anything that's happening right here and right now. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. Not trying to get anywhere or get rid of anything. Everything belongs. Everything has its place. Our job is to accept and to learn from the present moment. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. Just happy, just to be sitting here. It's a quiet and cool room. allowing the different thoughts to come and go in the mind, allowing the different sensations to rise and fade away in the body. It's a few more minutes before the meditation session ends. So now is the time just to reflect on the experience. How does it feel just to be sitting here with your eyes closed, focusing on a mantra? Does it feel just to be with the breathing process? How does it feel just to be with the body as it is? Mind will distract you. That's okay. Distraction feels just like that. The mind was peaceful. Of peace just feels just like that as well. With meditation, we get in touch with the state of our mind, our emotional interior, what things that we've been not paying attention to, what things we're trying to suppress, allow them to come to the front as well, to understand ourselves a little bit more. So I'm going to roll, I'm going to ring the gong 3 times. When the 3rd gong has faded away, you open your eyes and come out of the meditation. So, any questions or comments? Yes.
Have you actually been able to stop thoughts arising?
Yeah, you don't stop the thoughts, but they do stop on their own. Yeah, there's many, as a monk, we generally don't talk about our own personal experience, but there are plenty of monks who do certainly describe stages where the mind is not thinking. You're still aware, it's not like you're sleeping. You're very aware, almost hyper aware, present, but you're just not thinking. Yeah. Very quiet, and so this emptiness, quiet. But a lot of bliss, a lot of rapture. And you're aware of the, and that's the thing, you know, you can see, when you focus on one thing, everything else fades away. Example is like when you're focused on the bullseye, right? All you see is the bullseye. Everything else around it, it's not there anymore. When you're doing something, you focus on what you're doing. The whole world seems to fade away. It's the same when you are meditating. You focus on the breath, and that's all you're aware of, just the breathing process. The body disappears, thinking disappears. Everything disappears other than the breath. So you're aware of the breath and nothing else. Time can pass, an hour, 2 hours, there's like a flash of time. Oh, I'm just watching my breath. Oh wow, it's 4 hours already. That's interesting. Yeah. Body's not aching anymore, it's not hurting. All you're aware of is just the breath. And it's a very, very pleasant sensation. Yeah. It is our obsessions with focus on the body at the time that we feel the aches and the pain. But imagine when you're not focused on that, focused on something else. All that fades away. And it's very enjoyable. Yeah, you can sit there comfortably. Yeah, for a long, long time. Yes?
What's the longest period you've ever meditated for?
I think at a certain point in your meditation, you don't really time yourself. It's just sitting, right? Yeah, until, you know, the mind is comfortable and then you move. But I think when I was a novice, 4 hours.
Wow.
But I was doing kind of a practice of different ways of working with painful feelings. So one way to watch the painful feelings of the body is when you sit there and don't move. First hour, 2 hours, after 2 hours, things start to get interesting. The pain starts to come, it becomes stronger and stronger, different parts of the body. Yeah. So one way to keep yourself awake, that's for sure. Hard to go to sleep when your knee's on fire. But I don't recommend it for most people. It's you have to do plenty of stretching and know yourself. Yeah, some people do try to push through it and try to use too much willpower. And then obviously, they have to go get knee surgery or something. So don't do that, I'm not responsible. Because they do read books and biography about these meditation masters. They would sit 8 hours all night long. And then, I want to do that. Yeah. So you have to know when you're ready. And you will. You'll see that you just sit, it's get like a gradual organic process. The mind becomes more calm. You'll find that you sit longer and longer naturally without having to watch the clock. Just more peaceful. Yeah. Other times, you sit for a little bit and things start to get achy. Yeah, so always just work with the mind. Don't be too kind of hard or have a hard and fast rule that you always have to sit for an hour. Sit until it becomes a bit painful, and then stay with the pain for a little bit, and then if it becomes starts to increase, becomes a bit harder, then just change your posture, do a bit of walking meditation, a bit of stretching. Yeah, no need to try to kind of grit your teeth for a whole hour or something like that, because you read somewhere or somebody sitting next to you is sitting for longer, so you're gonna kind of outdo them.
What's your favorite meditation?
Generally, if you mean that what method I generally use, it's kind of a few different ones, but the one I do use the most is the mindfulness of the breathing. Yeah, so it's natural. And it's something that just your mind just sort of goes to it. First you relax the body, and then when the body is kind of relaxed and feeling still, the breathing process comes up naturally. Yeah, that's the only thing that's moving in the body when the body is kind of relaxed still. But I do a bit of metta meditation as well. This kind of concept of friendliness, acceptance, gentleness to yourself and others. Yeah. I find that living in a community is important. You work with other people, you live with other people. It's good to do this meditation on friendliness, on acceptance, forgiveness to yourself and others. And you find that just makes your relationship much easier. Because we hold on little grudges, disappointment, arguments, and they don't fall on the self. A lot of times we just hold on to it subconsciously. And by consciously bringing these ideas of friendliness, of well-wishing to others, you can begin to, you feel that you can let go of these little kind of irritations that arises when we live with others. Because there's, you know, there's always, you know, slight disappointments, disagreements from time to time. Yeah, that's what this is. It's just normal part of life. Yes?
Is relaxation and meditation same thing?
Excuse me?
Relaxation and the meditation similar?
Relaxation
and meditation?
Yes, certainly in the beginning. It's a way to really relax and calm the mind down. So a lot of time we live fast, but then we're stressed. So meditation, way to relax. But once the mind is relaxed, you find that it becomes a bit more more energetic as well. Yeah, and this is kind of weird thing. Unless you meditate, it's hard to understand. That becomes really energetic, but it's not restless. You feel really energetic, really bright, but also very peaceful as well. Yeah. So sometimes people feel energetic and they run around and want to do things, but an energetic mind is the opposite. That's really bright, really clear, very, very peaceful, very still as well. Yeah. It's an interesting feeling. Yeah, bright, clear, but in the moment, and it's just right there. But you're not having to do anything. You're not thinking a million miles an hour. You don't work everything. You're just happy just to be here. Yeah. Just watching life just flow through. And everything's okay. Everything's all right. Everything belongs. Nothing's out of place. Nothing you have to get rid of. Nothing you have to get. You're just happy and content in the moment. Yeah. Certainly in the beginning of meditation is relaxation. It's not only when you're sitting with your eyes closed. It's also, I encourage people to do yoga, stretching, anything that, you know, helps you focus on the body and relax in the body as well. Yeah. A lot of time, you know, we're in our head. And focus on the body, and then we don't, you know, pay enough attention to it. And our shoulder can be quite slump, and it can be quite tense. You know, tightening the jaws and all that stuff, and you get this headache. But if you're aware of the body, you can just relax when the muscles start to tighten up. And then you'll find that, yeah, the mind is more at ease as well. Body becomes more comfortable. But it is a gradual process, something that you need consistency. You need to do it a few minutes a day, but every day. Yeah. You find that, yeah, your strength just starts to increase naturally. The things that normally will annoy you for some reason, it doesn't get to you anymore. Yeah. And life is just a pleasant experience, instead of like, oh God. Not one of those days again.
Can you talk to us about Sydney and Angel Monastery there?
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the monastery is Wat Buddha Dhamma. It was founded about 40 plus years ago, 1978. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first monasteries in Australia, actually. Mm-hmm. And when I went there, it was founded by a German nun who bought the land and donated to the foundation. And the first abbot is an English monk. But after about 15 or 16 years, he changed his mind and became a lay person again. So then the monastery turned into a kind of meditation center, because it didn't have a steady community of monks staying there. You have different monks and nuns coming, but no one stayed there for a long time. So I turned to a meditation center. And over the years, different ethnic groups started to establish their own monastery. So they don't come out to Wat Buddhadhamma, which is like 3 hours away from Sydney, which is a bit far. And also, it's a very beautiful location, but it's also very secluded, which means it's 2 hours drive to the nearest town, and it's on a 16-kilometer dirt road, rough dirt road. It's in the middle of a national park. Very beautiful once you get there, but getting there can be a bit of a challenge. Yeah, it's a rough road. So sometimes we get there, people don't know, they bring their nice car, the BMW, the Mercedes, you don't see them again. Most of our supporters usually have a rough ute, a kind of older car. They don't mind coming on the dirt road. So, and normally, because it's too far from the city, we don't get regular people bring food like Borignana. So we have a few families that bring groceries on the weekends. And then during the weekdays, the different lay people come and practice meditation. They cook up whatever they find in the kitchen. Yeah. So we have about 6 monks staying there for this year, and about 4 to 6 lay people at any one time. Yeah, they come and stay. People stay for, you know, 5 days to a year and a half. We have a, you know, kind of a Dutch lady staying there. We have another lady from New South Wales. So she's been there about 3 years now. Yeah, so people can stay long term. Yeah. And it's very beautiful. It's one of the reasons why I stayed. I always just had a look. And I was surprised, like, you know, there's a very beautiful meditation hall that's been built about 20 years ago. And nice piece of forest, yeah, very green. And middle, so you have, you know, 220 acres of the monastery, but you have thousands of acres around it because it's in the middle of the national park. Yeah, no neighbors to worry about. A few cyclists on the weekend, that's pretty much it. And it's built on a historic, like, kind of world heritage called the Great Old Northern Road, built by convicts about 150 years ago. The road itself, beautiful feat of engineering. So yeah, so we can walk around. People walk around during the weekends and stuff like that. Yeah. And we're very green. It's too far for electricity. No electricity, solar power, and water tank. We're using water tank. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, you know, these days, like, they don't use. They say, oh, water tank. You can't drink it. But it, for us, it's no problem drinking, you know, water from the water tank, from the rain water. When I first came, I asked the manager, because at Borignana, they're pretty strict. They clean the water tank once every 3 years, drain everything, you know, wash it with soap and stuff like that. So I asked the manager, oh, how long? When's the last time you cleaned this tank? We're like, what clean? I'm like, okay, where did she clean it? And then so I'm looking, and we're looking at the gutter and the overflow, and open the tank. I've been drinking this water for 6 months. I usually have a pretty sensitive stomach, but I've been drinking the water, it seems fine. But I was a bit surprised when I lifted the tank. Lots of things floating there. But it shows that, you know, it's not a problem. Obviously, you know, we drink it and we're fine. But we do clean it once every 3 years now.
It's like
the itinerary for the day.
Itinerary day, we are into group practice, so it's 4 to 6 in the morning, and wake up, some monks wake up at 2 o'clock, because they have to go down and light the fire for the sala, but most people wake up about 3:30, down into the meditation hall by 4, a bit of chanting, so about 4:30, and 4:30 to 6, you sit and walk, as you see fit, and then we end the session with a bit of a reading, Dhamma reflection, a reflection for the day. And then there's breakfast. People have breakfast between 6:15 to about 6:45. And then back in the meditation hall, 7 to 9. A bit more sitting, a bit more walking. Yeah. And then 9 to 10 o'clock, the meal's at 10 o'clock. We eat, help clean up to about noon. And then there's work. So we work from 12 to 2, a bit of sweeping, a bit of toilet cleaning, paint if necessary, maintenance kind of thing. Yeah, 12 to 2, you rest between 2 to 6, have evening tea, and then 7 to 9 again. So about 6 hours of formal meditation. a day. Yeah. And then 2 hours of work. Because, as you know, monasteries are kind of by donations only. So monk, we don't work, we don't have a job. But I realized that people who support us have to work 8 hours. So as monks and visitors, we should put at least in 8 hours of work as well. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes?
Okay, helipad. You'll get people from Sydney.
Yeah, that's a suggestion. Well, I'm waiting for the drones. Once the drones get going, you can bring people in. Yes?
Tell us about keeping the presence and
meditation. Yes. Sometimes when you look at meditation, you think, oh, but that's all there is to the practice. But actually, the Buddha did teach that for the path, the whole practice to work and have power, it's also what you do outside of meditation. A lot of it is, you know, living a simple lifestyle and harmless, not harming yourself and not harming others. So we talk about these kind of ethical conduct or precepts that a Buddhist or a practitioner keep. And I try to explain to people, you're not a Buddhist because you're a Thai, you're born to a Thai family, and they're Buddhist, that makes you Buddhist, or Vietnamese, or traditional Buddhist, or Sri Lankan, or whatever. You're not a Buddhist because you're born into a cultural or a ethnical family. You're a Buddhist because what you do. So Buddhist is a person who keeps the 5 precepts, not killing any living beings, not stealing anything that's not yours, not taking anything that's not yours, no sexual misconduct, no lying, and no intoxicants. So even if you're a Thai person, you don't keep these precepts, you really can't call yourself a Buddhist, even if you're born into a Buddhist family. Yeah. Because some people say, oh yeah, I'm a Buddhist because my parents are Buddhist. Oh, not really. Yeah. And these precepts are not like if you break them, you fall into hell or something, you're punished. No, it's just a skillful way to live. A wholesome lifestyle. That way when you sit down, you don't get worried about, people are going to find out that I lied to them, or, am I cheating on my tasks, I'm cheating other people. The more you kind of live wholesome, and more you don't hurt yourself or others, you just have this sense of peace and stillness. It doesn't worry the mind, because you're going to get caught, or somebody might, do something, harm you back. Yeah, because you're not harming yourself or others. And that's also that killing in living beings. You kill, you hunt, you fish. There's a feeling unease. You can sense it. And the more sensitive you are, the more you meditate, you can just feel it. That harming other beings. We all want to experience happiness. We want to be free from suffering. And to harm others, it's just you can feel that. Yeah, sure, a mosquito can't communicate. But you can feel that, it feels pain as well. The dog feels pain, you kick it as well. Yeah. So you're more sensitive to beings around you. And you knowing that you yourself don't want to experience any pain. So they're not living creatures, enjoy pain as well. Yeah. So you're more careful of how you relate to other beings, living or animal, around you. We encourage people. You don't have to kind of drag your feet around, but just brush the mosquito off when it's biting you. Take it outside, sweep the ants that's in the house, the cockroaches, and all. Just bring it outside. Yeah, just a bit of gentleness. And it takes clarity, mindfulness to be aware, But also, it doesn't mean that when you walk around, you're not mindful, you're stepping on things. That's not intentional. So the ethical conduct is the intentional, hurting other people. You intention not to. When you're driving, things fly into your windshield, well, you can't do much about it. Yeah, so it's more the ability not to harm any beings around us. Yeah, and you'll find that the more you keep those things, the more it helps to settle the mind. You find that when you sit and close your eyes, there's nothing that the guilt or remorse that comes up when you're hurting other people that could come up. Yeah, so the precepts helps to settle the mind down, and then meditation starts to improve. The more simple your lifestyle, the more harmless you are, the more gentle you are. And that's why you encourage people to practice generosity, helping others around you, sharing what you have. Because so much we think it's our stuff, but it isn't. You can't take it when you leave, when you die. And when you share, you give other people, it brings happiness. And when you reflect on that, it's something that you that kind of carries you, something that sustains you. That, you know, our life is just not for ourselves, but it's also for others around us. It doesn't be grand gestures of, you know, great giving. It could be just a smile, just, you know, taking the time to listen to a friend, taking time just to help a friend, allowing people just to cut in when they're driving around, not getting too flustered, not getting, you know, trying to beat people to the lines, and just allow people to pass you or whatever. Yeah, just a little, you know, kind of acts of kindness throughout the day. Helps you just, you know, increase a sense of happiness, sense of well-being. Yeah. Something that you can try for yourself. Just not take my word for it. Just, you know, look around and help where you can. You'll find it out. Yeah, but certainly I'm more happier. And certainly that's what I recommend to people who are, you know, oh, I'm not feeling very well. I'm just kind of depressed. What should I do? Well, I want a happiness. But that's the way life tells us. Oh, when you want to be happy, you got to go and treat yourself nice. Go on holiday. Buy yourself a nice thing. Like have a new car or something, a new toy. That's not really a road to happiness. It's very short. You want to be happy? I tell people, go make someone else happy. You'd be surprised how quickly that flows back. Yeah. But a lot of people go, no, I don't want to make them happy. I want to be happy first. Yeah, try that too. Go buy yourself a present and see how long that lasts. Yeah, that's the thing. And it's the law of karma. Whatever you give out flows back to you eventually. To give out worry, anxiety, harming, hurting other people, that goes back to you. But you give out safety, give out happiness, and those things flow back to you as well in different ways. So we are, you can see we're connected, especially with the family. You can't be truly happy if somebody in the family is suffering or not getting along. And we can sense that. Yeah. So our happiness in some ways is tied to others. Yeah. So knowing that we try to look after everybody you come into contact with. In different ways. And we help where you can, but obviously, you know, you can't solve the world's problem overnight either. So it's to understand that, you accept that. But you can do little things on a daily basis to help things. Sure, you might not be able to solve climate change, it's not really up to us to set policies in that way. But you can, you know, help do little acts of kindness and gentleness to the people around you where you can. And it's certainly something that each and every one of us is capable of doing. Yeah. So as Buddhists, we don't try to change the world overnight. We try to change the world around you, starting with yourself. And then that starts to radiate outward. And you find out, yeah, maybe you can change the world. But starting with this thing first, right here. Yes?
What's your favorite sutta?
My favorite sutta? It's a few. But the one that comes to mind was, I think it's the one about on the respect for the Dhamma, where the Buddha talks about, the general pointing your feet in a certain direction, and that how, like, you know, the king, one of the king is a big supporter of the Buddha, and he says, you know, I give this general their livelihood. I promote them, I give them, you know, a nice salary, I look after them really well. But when they sleep, they put their head towards the Buddha and they put their feet towards me. It shows how much respect they have for the Buddha. And the Buddha goes on to explain that, yeah, the respect they have for him is not because, you know, he's so innately wonderful, but because they derive a lot of benefits through listening to his teachings. And the more you practice, you know, the teaching of the Buddha, more, you know, the more you practice the Dhamma, the more peace and stillness, the happiness you experience. And then so gratitude is just a natural course of a natural result of having experienced the benefit of the teaching itself. You know, like, you know, even my own personal life, I have a lot of gratitude for the people who've kind of helped me to become a monk, introduced me to Buddhism and meditation. Because when you start serving as priests, you're like, wow, what an amazing gift that someone's given you that you cannot find anywhere in the world, really. To be able to discover peace and stillness, be able to discover just the ability to, you know, to train your own mind. Yeah, it's not something that's easily find in the world. And once you taste a little bit of peace, you're like, wow, I understand how precious that is. And that's something that's not easily find in anywhere else except in your own mind. And you have so much gratitude for people who introduce you to the teaching and to the practice as well. Yeah.
From the UN Peace Corps to Buddhism and a monk.
Yeah, something like that.
Come on. Tell us more.
No, it was very coincidental. I grew up in a Catholic family. It's pretty worldly. And I didn't wasn't very spiritual in that sense. I was happy, you know, working in banking, stockbroking. I was an immigrant, so I was programmed very young on that, you know, success means a good job, it means lots of money, that's what happiness means. That's what I was told anyway. And for the most part, it's pretty good.
Did you work in the pulpit?
I was more a stock analyst, so we would make recommendations, write reports about different companies, and they'd go on road shows, you know, Europe, Hong Kong, Singapore, New York, and London, and just sell the different stocks that you recommend. And it worked long hours. Stress, I didn't mind the stress. And now they do more studying, which I feel is what's innately true. It's not that stress is a problem, but it's that I don't like it is a problem. And I'm not crazy about, you know, having meet deadline, but I come from, like I said, a poor family. And I know that early in life, they don't give you money for nothing. So I was quite happy to work 16 hours and, you know, turn out the reports and do the traveling. Because that's what happens. You know, that's what they want you to do. They pay you the big bucks to work really hard. So I didn't feel stressed. I feel that it's part of the job. So yeah, I was quite happy doing what I was doing. But just by chance, I was working in Bangkok and a friend of mine became a monk for short term. So then he was just like, you know, kind of a spiritual tourist. He went to the bars and the beaches and, you know, that gets boring after a while. So I want to do something new, he says. So he read that you can become a monk in Thailand for 2 weeks.
What?
Yeah. So he became a monk, but he was really, really, really bored. He's like, oh, you can't watch TV, you can't eat in the afternoon. I'm really bored. You gotta come in and keep me company. So I came in. And that's my introduction to Buddhism. Yeah. And yeah. And I met this monk who introduced me to meditation, teaching the Buddha on karma, and he said, if you're a really good meditator, you can see the future. I was stockbroker. I was like, oh yes, that's what I need. I'm a much better stock picking, I can see the future. So I really spent the whole weekend really focused on my breathing, not focused on thinking of anything else. Yeah.
He tricked you, didn't he?
He did. He got me interested. You know, I was really greedy, really stockbroker, so I knew that's how I got me to meditate. And the thing is, that's the interesting thing, was that, so I was kind of in transition. During that time, it was 1998, the Thai stock market crashed already, 6 months earlier. I was on a contract, and they had to pay me anyway. But there was not a whole lot to do. There's no volume. People are fed up. No one's doing anything. But I'm just twiddling my thumb, getting paid, which is not bad. But so I was in the space where, you know, I was looking for something else. And you know, when the stock market goes up, you think, you're a genius. Everything I pick goes up. Well, of course, the market goes up. Everything goes up. But then when it starts going the other way, you're like, oh no, I don't have the answers to everything. Well, I can be wrong. Ooh, maybe there's another way to look at the world. And also I was seeing, you know, like working really hard and seeing my boss, you know, wealthy people. But they didn't look exactly happy. And I was told that if you're rich, then you'll be happy. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. Something wrong with this equation here. These guys are kind of pretty wealthy, lots of cars, lots of houses, lots of mistresses, and they don't look very happy. So why am I working so hard in 20 years time? I'm gonna be like one of them. Having a few things, toys, but not so happy. So, in contrast, I was like, I took time up and met these monks and met a few other monks as well. And they looked really, really happy, really at peace. So that got me really thinking, yeah, okay, what should I do? So I did the time then and there, within a month, just take a whole year off to learn meditation and see what that's like. So it's just more of, wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be a monk for the rest of my life or anything. I was like, oh, yeah, meditation is interesting. And I did feel quite refreshed just for the few days in meditation in the monastery. So it made me curious because, I came from an environment of like, work hard, play hard and work hard. No one taught me anything about contentment, about peace, or good enough. I was like, I always want more. More is better. Yeah. And so when I discovered that, this peace and stillness, that's interesting. Yeah. And it is. It gave me a sense of like really a contentment that I didn't really know in life. I'm constantly rushing around. I was hyperactive. I drink coffee just to slow myself down, really.
Seriously?
Yeah, I was like hyperactive people. Like, do you want to sleep? Oh, I'm missing out on the world by sleep. So it's that very little. And I was doing run and run, kind of dinner appointments, going to the gym, vacations on weekends, always doing something. Yeah, because I'm missing the world. But then when I discovered meditation and peace, there's something clicked. Yeah, something that was very enjoyable, but also something I wasn't used to. So that's why I took the time just to kind of, I'm going to take a year off and see what happens. Yeah. So a year turned to 5 years, 5 years turned to about 20 years, and I'm still here.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you end up at Bodh Nyama?
I was in Thailand, and then I did speak Thai. I'm not Thai, obviously, I'm Vietnamese. So then I went to the International Monastery by Ajahn Chah and became a monk there. And then during that time, Ajahn Brahm was quite well known. He was teaching, the Samadhi, deep meditation. Yep. And I was thinking, my Thai is not great, so why don't I, learn some... and I was really keen meditator. So why don't I learn, meditation instructions from an English-speaking person who can explain directly to me, as opposed to through a translator. Yeah. And it was only a 1 year exchange program they had between Bodh Nyana and Wat Phanarachat, the Thai monastery at the time. After 1 year, there was room, so I asked to stay for another year. And then, just 1 year, turned out to be 7 years. And then after a few years, I thought, I should go back to Thailand. But then Ajahn Brahm by then asked me whether I could stay on and help train the younger monks or something. So I stayed on for a few more years. Yeah. So that's how we end up with Ajahn Brahm, who also he ordained in Thailand as well. So that's why that's the connection was. Yeah.
You didn't pick up all his bad jokes then.
Well, I picked up a few. It's conditioning; you can't help it. You hear so many bad jokes day in and day out. It's just rough.
So.
Are your siblings still trying to get you back on the right path?
They do, they keep asking. My mom, who's very deeply Catholic, is like, we have churches, really nice churches. You can meditate in them, I do, I say, I would, but... in the beginning, yeah. And I do really grateful for my mother, because you can't ordain someone unless you have your parents' permission, even though if you're, I was 32 at the time. But I still had needed my mother's permission. And she hated it. But she didn't say anything. She said, "You make me happy, I'll support you." Yeah. And only later my dad told me, by the way, she did not like that at all. But she gave you permission to go ahead anyway. And which was very, very generous of her. And I go back, go to church with my mother as well, so yeah, makes her happy.
Yeah, that's sort of similar to John Bramali, because his parents went all that.
That's right. Well, very keen as well.
They all came around.
They do. When they see it, first you thought, it's some kind of weird cult, you live in the forest and no money, no sex, definitely something weird. So she did fly all the way from LA to my ordination, which is on very short notice. They don't tell you ahead of time in Thailand. It's just like, we're ordaining you in a couple of days' time. Let me call my mother. So she came over, it's 3:00 in the morning, she came and you know she looked at it, and then she stayed a few days at the monastery in Thailand and realized, yeah, there is, you know, a lot of good people trying to, you know, live the holy life in the ways that they're aware of. A lot of different nationalities, so you see that people are, you know, living a simple lifestyle, yeah, and not hurting other people, and not, you know, just kind of in the forest. Yeah, so she did feel that much more at ease when she saw the monastery itself and everything, yeah. But every so often she did say, oh. Especially my sibling, they're like, okay, okay, you're gonna be normal again? Well, that was normal. I did tell them, you guys do anything interesting, I'll come out. But they haven't done anything interesting. New jobs, more kids, more houses, lose their jobs, divorces. It's all the same, just goes around.
Have you ever questioned, like doubted becoming a monk?
Yeah, all the time. Still not quite know whether it's the right decision or not.
Really?
But generally it's going well enough. I mean, and doubting is just part of a doubting mind. I just know that it's this doubt. I'm not hugely doubting, like not like racking my mind out. But you know, thoughts come up, oh yeah, you know, could have been different or could have gone different ways. I'm sure I could have. If my mother, you know, really strongly objected, I would have come back. Different things happened, I would have moved, but after a while you understand this non-self thing, that I'm not really driving, it's not like me doing the thing, it's just things, doors open in a certain way and different doors close. And it's just leading my, in a certain direction. I'm just floating along with it. Yeah. And I have, the, you know, being in the business where I have this 5-year plan. So I always tell people, I'm good for 5 years. After that, who knows? Yeah, it's kind of a rolling 5-year kind of thing.
How many years now?
It's been 19 years. 21 years if you count the non-monk year, because you have to train for 2 years first before they ordain you. It's about 21 years. Yeah, because sometimes I see people come to the monastery and like, okay, I've done it. I'm focused, I've sold the house, you know, gave my wife everything, gave my kid away. I'm ready to become a monk I'm ready to become a monk forever. And 2 weeks later, like, oh no, I gotta go. So the mind's a tricky thing. So you're gonna keep it, okay, yeah, you know, this is going well enough, but who knows? It's all impermanent. See what happens.
It'd be awkward asking the wife for the money back.
Yeah, a few of them go, oh. And then sometimes, you know, the monks, you know, the one monk, he gave his wife everything and he wants to come back. She's like, no. I'm happy now. No refund, come on.
What do you miss about Thailand, the hot weather or the hot food?
The food is not bad. I don't miss the hot weather, that's for sure. I do come back once a year, though. Just connect with Wapananachai and connect with certain different spiritual masters as well. But no, I mean, we're very blessed. Because, you know, Thailand has this strength, you know, lots of, you know, where Buddhism is, and Ajahn Chah started there, and lots of meditation master. But Asia is very crowded, and they have different concepts regarding noise. Every time they have a party, they want to share that music to everybody around them. Where the West is, yeah, very quiet that way. And lots of land. Australia, you know, big piece of land, and, you know, 100 acres, not aware. Whereas Thailand, you know, there's lots of people around you, and they're fairly noisy as well. Yeah. So Buddhism spreading in the West is wonderful. The fact that we can practice, you know, in the bush, you know, elsewhere, and you know, the way that the Buddha did 2,500 years ago, all the way in India. Yeah, for me, that's an amazing blessing that we have. Yeah. And also in the, you know, the bush, Australia is great.
So you were up in Isan,
yeah? Yeah, I was up in Isan, yeah. And you know, it's just mostly farmland, just that patch from the monastery, yes. It's trees, everything else is just, you know, farmland. Yeah, it's very flat.
Yeah, I worked up there quite a long time, and there's temples everywhere, isn't there?
There is.
One on every corner, isn't there?
There is a temple, yeah, every corner. A lot of it's just culture centered. The monks just would, you know, kind of do a lot of rites and rituals and a lot of counseling more. Yeah, so it's more like culture centered. They used to, that's where the kids go to school as well. So now they're not so popular because, you know, obviously the kids go to high school and go to regular school. They don't go to monasteries to be school anymore.
The place I was involved with, if there were anybody in the village that really couldn't get any work and had no money, they'd go and work at the temple, and the temple would give them a bit of money.
Yeah,
help
that's
them
right.
through, you know.
That's right, that's
so
right. It's a culture centre.
And job centre.
It is, yeah, Center Lane.
Prayers,
yeah.
Everything.
That's right. Yeah, like Center Lane, local high school, local
yeah.
counselling thing, local funeral, there's everything.
Dog centre.
Yeah, all the dogs go there, stray dogs, stray cats, stray kids, everything goes there. You can't do anything, you know, like, you know, you're a girl, you know, you're a boy, and you can't work on the farm, you get terrible grades, you can't do anything, guess where they send you?
The monks.
Monastery. The monks will just kind of do something. Yes.
When you mentioned about the meditation, is in your experience, like with meditation, can you really see the future?
Like I said, I cannot talk about my personal experience, but I have no doubt that you can see the future. There are monks who can. But also, with anything, it's just not the reason to meditate, because you know those things can also distract you from peace and stillness. Yeah, meditate to get something can be a bit distracting after a while. Yeah. So some monks can see the future, and some people it happens naturally, spontaneous for them. But unless you have deep wisdom, it can be quite, anxiety-inducing. Makes you anxious. You know, there's this nun, she's, you know, I heard, I don't know her, but I heard another monk talk about it. There's this nun who just naturally just decided to have this vision about things that's going to happen. And made her really nervous. She didn't know what she was supposed to do with it. I'm supposed to just warn people or see things and people, you know, what am I supposed to do with this knowledge, she says. And then she was so relieved after a few years that it disappeared. That she didn't have to kind of, because you see things, am I supposed to do something with it, tell people, warn people, if you see people getting hurt or whatever, but if you can't stop these things, you know, they happen anyway. Yeah, yeah. So unless you have deep wisdom to, you know, just see things clearly and help where you can and just be equanimous where you can't, it is quite stressful. Yeah. So sometimes we think, oh, it's great to see the future. Not always. Because you don't always see what you want to see. You must see something else and like, oh, what am I supposed to do with this now?
What are numbers?
that's what the Thais always ask. What numbers do you see in meditation, Ajahn?
They sell them outside the temples, don't they, all the time?
Yeah, they do. And some temples really play upon that. But in our tradition, it's forbidden. You can't talk about those things. You don't give numbers out. You don't give dates about, you know, weddings dates. And what's the auspicious date of weddings? And what's the auspicious date to start business or anything? We can't do any of that stuff. So we don't get too many visitors.
No levitating?
That's right, no levitating. No walking through walls.
You did say you were Vietnamese. Where did you come from?
Yes.
Where in Vietnam?
From the south. My parents, my mother, my father worked for the army, so we had to get out because we're on the losing side, so it wasn't very good. Yeah, so 75, they were evacuated, and we end up in Southern California.
So where in the south?
Saigon?
Oh,
Ho Chi Minh City?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ho Chi Minh City. Yeah. I've come back a few times. Yeah, it's very different.
It is different.
Yeah, just don't know how the U.S. lost. They don't have anything. I don't mind.
They're number 10.
Thank you. How long are you going to be here for, John? Sunday night.
Okay.